Rabbi Robert Barr here. Rather than this being one of my typical commentaries, this is a conversation that I had with Rabbi Rachel Sabbath Beit Halachmi. It is part one of a three-part conversation. Joining me and us today is Rachel Sabbath Beit Halachmi, a dear friend, Rabbi, PhD, and I want to, we're going to have a conversation about events that have transpired in your life. But first, before we do that, I want to introduce you to our community. Rachel has been the assistant professor of Jewish thought and ethics at the Cincinnati campus of the Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion. We've talked about Hebrew Union College before. I was trained there, as well as many of the interns that you've met over the years. She served as the national director of recruitment and admissions at the Hebrew Union College from
2013.
And you also have been the vice president of the Shalom Hartman Institute, which is in Jerusalem, in North America. Could you just talk just a second about the Shalom Hartman Institute? Because many of us don't know what it is.
Sure. It's an internationally renowned leadership training institute, which was founded in Jerusalem by the late Rabbi Professor David Hartman and runs programs for lay leaders, Christians, Muslims, and primarily also for Jewish leaders and senior officers of the IDF. It's a think tank also based in Jerusalem.
So it's a think tank about Israeli issues.
And leadership and democracy and pluralism.
That's great.
And
so,
interfaith as well.
Wonderful. So you have, a remarkable career. And I've had some wonderful people on, very bright people on. I mean, you certainly top the list. I mean, seriously, when you look at Rachel's resume and all the, your educational background and all the things you've done, you have been a leader in the Jewish community for really years, and you have made an important contribution. And that's why what happened to you is so stunning, and that you were willing to speak about it publicly is so important. And I want you to just share the story that you're able to share and willing to share with our community as you understand.
Well, first of all, thank you, Rabbi Barr, for the invitation. It's always a pleasure and honor to be with you and to think deeply with you. And of course, often we've talked about philosophers of previous ages. And really, this is about current events. This is about the status of our community. This is about the ethical nature in which we want human beings and certainly religious communities to operate. And what I learned, this began actually in 1995. I was 27 years old and I had just been ordained. And certainly events had happened prior to that in my life that now we would describe as Me Too and sexual harassment and assault and discrimination. But there was something very particular about the event that we'll focus on today, and that was actually the subject of a New York Times article about a month ago, where being a newly ordained rabbi amongst rabbis from all the different denominations as part of a pluralistic think tank in New York City, we were studying the biblical idea that comes from the first chapter of Genesis, that all human beings are created in the image of God, and that all human beings are all the children of the same original parents, Adam and Eve, and that none of us can say that we are greater than the other. None of us can say we are more unique. None of us can say we are of greater value. And in Genesis chapter 1, it's very clear that this should apply both to male and female, that God created male and female both in the image of God. So this was the subject that we were studying, and the funder of the internship, it wasn't an internship, it was actually my first rabbinic position, but the funder who was funding all of us, Michael Steinhardt, asked to meet with us and to hear about our work.
Could you pause for 1 second? So we should know who Michael Steinhardt is. He was the funder for this program, but he's more than just the funder of this particular
program.
Right.
So Michael Steinhardt is probably one of the wealthiest and most influential philanthropists in North America, not just in the Jewish community, but in North America. He's a major funder in the art world, a major funder in universities, a major funder of some of the largest projects in North America and in Israel. So a person of enormous financial and leadership and philanthropic influence and power.
So some people might know of Steinhardt through Birthright. That was one of his major, he was a major contributor.
Right, he's a founding funder.
So you may know, if you've ever heard of Birthright, and that may be where you've heard the name, or if you've been to New York and been to one of the art galleries or one of the museums where his name is posted. So this is who you were meeting with. So it was you as a 27-year-old, newly ordained rabbi,
right,
was meeting this very influential, very renowned, probably isn't the right word, but well-known individual, a key figure in the American Jewish experience.
And extremely important. And as we were preparing for the meeting, I was told it was very important for the future funding of the institution and of our positions.
So, right, I think that needs to be understood again, because that's really important. A lot of times when you're in a program that's being funded, when you meet with the funders, they're hoping that they want you to make a very good impression.
Right, and they want them to continue their funding.
And not upset them even more so.
Right, and yes. So we were each meeting with him, and in the course of my meeting with him, he immediately asked if I was married and if I had a boyfriend. And then he asked me when I was going to start to put my uterus and my womb, he said, my body to work. And I said, excuse me? And he said, well, you should really get married and have children. And don't you think there's a population crisis in the Jewish community? And I said something about how I'm 27 years old and I hope to meet my intended one, my Bashert. And he proceeded to say, well, you know, you could be a Pilegesh. And I wasn't sure what that term meant, in fact, I will admit. And I turned to a young Orthodox rabbi who was sitting next to me to make sure that I understood correctly. And I said, doesn't Pilegesh mean a concubine, like the biblical notion of concubine, like a co-wife, an additional wife? And he said, yes, exactly. I think we should reinstate this notion and this category. And at that moment, one of his young trader people came in, a young man.
He was a financial guy. When you say trader, as in financial trading.
Right.
I want to make sure we got the term.
Thank you. Yes, financial. He was a financial trader. And he came in and he said, look, you know, you could sleep with this guy and have more Jewish babies. And I said, again, I'm 27 years old, and I'm looking to, you know, find my own Besheret and build my own family, my own husband. And then he kept pressing it. He said, you could be my concubine. You could be my Pilegesh. And I said, excuse me. And I asked him a bunch of questions if he understood what he was saying. And I even asked him, you know, well, how would your wife feel about that? And he said something to the effect of, well, you know, I don't know how she'd feel about it, but I sure would enjoy it. So he kept pressing the issue, and I became increasingly uncomfortable. Eventually, the conversation ended, and that was 23 years ago. I've learned that since then, dozens and dozens of women have been sexually harassed and have been really emotionally tortured by him. There have been women who haven't come forward who've been sexually really accosted by him. And as I understand it, these may be allegations. But in the case of my story and of dozens of other women, there were many witnesses in the room.
Right.
And who saw it.
So just a couple points before we go. So the New York Times did an investigative story about this. So there is documentation and evidence and witnesses who testified. So if you want to see the depth of that, and for the other women as well. So this is not Rachel just telling a story alone, and that I'm asking you to say, well, just, and we should believe Rachel, because when someone tells a story, it's our obligation to believe it and listen to it. But the fact is, in our world right now, where these kind of questions are and these issues are so dramatic and so important to deal with, the New York Times, when they did their reporting, had an obligation as an institution to do all the research to collaborate what you're saying and to corroborate it, and they did.
I will say that also reporters had come to me over the years, and particularly in the last year, to ask me to come forward with my story. And I really felt out of respect for one of the rabbis in the room, who was really the director of the institution of the position, the think tank, Rabbi Yitz Greenberg, and also out of respect for the projects that Steinhardt was funding, and out of the shared beliefs. I believe in Birthright. I believe in the Jewish student organization Hillel on campus. I believe in so much of what was funding over the years, in the billions of dollars in projects in the state of Israel, that I really felt that I shouldn't come forward. I also obviously felt a great amount of personal concern of what this would mean for my own career and what it might mean to become a persona non grata in the Jewish community.
Given you were literally just starting out, I mean, you're just starting out.
And I was terrified.
And terrified. I mean, you're young. I mean, even if he hadn't done it, it's still a, meeting somebody who's funding, whose role is important. There's a sense of, as a rabbi, responsibility. More so now that he said these horrific things to you. There were people sitting there and didn't do anything.
One of them left.
And so we're going to talk. Obviously, there are multiple conversations we want to have. So, and for 20 years, you, out of respect, out of a sense of fear about what would happen if you spoke out, and a variety of, you did kept the story private. What, something changed, and you began to talk about it, and it became the New York Times article. There are other articles as well as an opinion piece that you wrote for Haaretz, which is a Israeli newspaper. You wrote for the English language paper. So what transpired that you felt that you needed to speak out?
A number of things happened. First of all, certainly the emergence of the Me Too movement meant that on a daily basis, women who had similar experiences, whether with President Trump or with other very significant people, Harvey Weinstein in Hollywood, and other stories, it felt that there was a constant retelling of my experience with Steinhardt, and I'd had a similar experience as one with a professor at a university when I was younger, and I felt that the stories were gaining a kind of cultural importance and significance that perhaps in 1995 the Jewish community and in fact Rabbi Greenberg himself didn't know what to do with these stories. I felt that the culture had come to a place where perhaps we do know what to do. Mm-hmm. Perhaps we can hear them. And the most important thing I think that happened was I learned that there were dozens and dozens of women in the two decades that had passed.
So
that it had been his victims, and that perhaps we needed to prevent the next victim from the next harassment from taking place, and that perhaps if we weren't able to stop Steinhardt, perhaps it's our obligation to make it very clear that this behavior is absolutely unacceptable, and that the bystanders in the room should know that they need to stand up, have a backbone, and also prevent such behavior, and that there shouldn't be any more victims.
Of course. I mean, there shouldn't be any more victims, and that you were willing to stand up and do something very bold and courageous, given that there are people sitting next to you who are really senior people who should have been bold and have your back and have had the willingness to stand up and to be bold, and they didn't, and that you're willing to do this now is very important. I think it's transformative, and it's important. So lots of questions. We're not going to actually be able to deal with them all in this conversation. We're going to have another one. So you stood up, you told your story. It's now been in multiple places. What has resulted from that? I mean, is it rainbows and roses, or is it been much harsher than when you tell your story that there is. Repercussions?
Well, I want to say that there's basically three major things that I've experienced. First of all, I have felt the power of, there were about six women in the New York Times article, but there were originally close to 30 women who were going to come forward just about these experiences in the Jewish community. And many of them felt, out of concern for their own jobs and families, that they couldn't come forward. I also understood that many were offered agreements not to disclose with some, agreements that I felt that I was not able to ever consider, that it was really my obligation. So there was something about standing together and really saying to this funder and hopefully to the larger community, literally, time's up. We are no longer going to accept this, and we're going to stand together. So I felt an incredible amount of support from these women, from the Me Too world, from the Time's Up world, and saying that we have to break the seal on these stories, and that the only way to prevent future victims is to really hold those responsible, both the offenders and the bystanders, to really hold them accountable. Mm-hmm. What that means, we should come to in a later conversation. The other major thing that happened along the way is that I felt that other cases that I had experienced in my professional career, that I must speak up about them. I must make sure that those responsible know what happened to me in other places.
So that this was not, highlight this a bit. This wasn't a singular event with only one donor, that this has happened other times.
This has happened other times that I don't want to be specific about. I want to focus on this incident, but I know that from my female rabbinic colleagues, I know that there are dozens and dozens of stories, and once I did go public, dozens and dozens of women have come to me and to other people involved in the story with their own stories, not with Michael Steinhardt, but with many, many other, primarily it's, you know, men harassing women, but there are other, certainly other cases as well. And I found out how much this is a very, very deep problematic issue, which is not just about money and power. It's primarily also about gender and power. And it certainly doesn't happen just to women, that many times the abuser is abusive to lots of people. However, when there's the gender component, there's really what I've come to understand is really the weaponizing of the male-female gender discrepancy being used against the woman, usually the junior partner, right, in the discussion. And so I felt that it was money and power, and clearly, I mean, what could be more sexual than discussing having sex?
Right. Right.
And suggesting that I have sex with him and be his concubine.
Right. And what is, I mean, the whole thing is horrific. The thing that, and we're going to have a separate conversation, but there were two, at least one rabbi, if not two rabbis, in the room who, and this is, so the Me Too move, the sexual harassment thing is awful. It shouldn't be taking place anywhere. And that it's taking place in the halls of Jewish, and I would call that a Jewish institution.
Yes.
For the moment.
Yes.
It was no longer just simply Steinhardt's office. It was representative of the Jewish community. There were rabbis present who sat silent. I mean, that speaks volumes about how far we have to go, that this could happen to a young rabbi who was clearly at that moment had to be overwhelmed with what to do, and looking to senior colleagues who just, one chuckled and the others, and one stood silent. Isn't it who was Elie Wiesel, I believe, who said, silence only helps the tormentor, never the tormented.
Right.
And so that silence spoke volumes as well. That you were willing to speak out and do this is incredibly powerful. And the reverberations are pretty amazing.
So I want to talk about also one of those rabbis in the room.
Mm-hmm.
Yitz Greenberg, who didn't hear it happen, but Steinhardt had also said really despicable things to another female colleague and part of that meeting. And we went to Rabbi Greenberg immediately thereafter, mm-hmm, and had several conversations with him. And he actually did say to Michael Steinhardt on this occasion and on other occasions, in other cases, that his behavior was absolutely out of bounds and unacceptable. But Michael Steinhardt persisted to harass women, really until I heard a story from just a couple months ago.
So he said, and we're going to draw to this, mm-hmm, piece. So he went and said, terrible thing, but will you give me money?
So I don't know the actual conversation.
I know
that he continued to receive money from him. I will say that Rabbi Greenberg, from that moment until now, quite literally now, we're in conversation and communication to this very day, actually ensured that I never needed to meet with him again, mm-hmm, or be funded by Steinhardt again. And also, he has written me an apology that he didn't understand how deeply that kind of experience had affected me and his role, that he should have understood then and understands, mm-hmm, now.
So what would be great, and I would say this, and if Rabbi Greenberg's watching, but if Rabbi Greenberg wants to join us here in Cincinnati to have a conversation about what it was like to be the bystander and to realize that being silent at a moment like that had repercussions for him as well, because not only have you had to live with what you experienced, so did the bystander.
Yeah.
And having to live with their silence at a moment when they could have changed the world. So we're going to conclude this part of the conversation This is going to be different than other services or conversations I've had with people over the years that we've been doing, having services together at ourjewishcommunity.org. Rachel's this story, and it's not, this story doesn't feel right, this history that you're sharing with us, the sense of what's happened to you and happened within the Jewish community, has multiple layers, and we want to spend time talking about each one of them and giving them the appropriate time. So this is the beginning of our conversation. You're going to need to join us in the weeks to come for the rest of our conversation.
This is Rabbi Robert Barr of Congregation Beth Adam at ourjewishcommunity.org. I hope you found the conversation that I had with Rabbi Rachel Sabbath Beit Halachmi as powerful as I did. Parts 2 and 3 of our conversation will be posted in the coming weeks. Thank you.